The other night I went up to King's Cross to visit somebody who had gone forward at the Billy Graham Crusade. I haven't been up there for quite some time, you'll be surprised to hear, seeing I live in the eastern suburbs, but the new bypass has enabled me to avoid it, I've noticed. But it looked brighter and cleaner and more lovely than ever. So attractive a place for people to go out and spend a pleasant evening walking around, looking at people, walking around, looking at people. And the lights were so bright these days, advertising everything under the sun. You could drive through that street down there, the main street there, without your lights on. You don't need it because everywhere around about you, people are alive and doing things. The rest of the suburbs may be dead, but King's Cross is so much the progressive part of the beautiful Sydney, the heart of the city, the place where things are alive all night long. And as I went visiting this man and into the house, into the flats that he went there, it presented me with great difficulty because he lived in a little street just, you know, a stone's throw from the very heart of the cross. And every house in the place and every flat in the place was all locked up. Not only so, but the windows had huge metal bars all across them. And the very flats to which I said thought that he lived in, it was a bit difficult actually, he said he lived in number 16 and there weren't 16 locks there. But when I worked out one that could possibly be his, there was a huge iron, wrought iron gate stuck across there. 80 or so flats in this building, but there was this wrought iron gate. You had to have a key to get in it. There was all wire mesh behind it. I finally waited till somebody went in and walked in straight behind him up to the flat where he was and knocked on the door. You saw the peephole had somebody peeping through it. The lock on the door was one of those Yale locks, but you heard a rattle of other locks being pushed across the doorway as well, and a chain finally established on the door, and then a quiet little voice said, "Who is it?" I explained who I was after and was assured that they didn't live there anymore, and so I left. There is King's Cross for us, isn't it? People who have to lock and shutter themselves away behind iron gates and grills and padlocks. There is life being lived to the full. There is the heart of our beautiful city, locked up, chained up, so that nobody might come in and rip them off in fear and anxiety and terror. That is the magnificent liberation that we come to in our society, a society which is basically falling apart. I mean, in terms of individuals, I'm not going to go on to the wars that we might look at or the strikes that are available to us to share in and fight about. I heard this morning on the ABC that child psychiatrists is concerned and putting forward the figures of one out of every 10 children in our schools having some mental disturbance. One out of 10. I hear Mike Willis is going to be discussing marriage breakups in a couple of days' time. Interesting idea, but I think I heard the figure him saying that one out of 4 marriages in New South Wales breaks up. You know that one out of 20 Australians have a serious drinking problem, which means actually 4 or 5 out of every 20 have it because the others have to live with that poor person. All through our society, people are unhappy, people are having difficulties. Now, you and I may not be. You and I may not be facing any of those kinds of difficulties. We might live in freedom and happiness with our door left wide open all the time and all the people who visit us only beautiful. We might have an easy job and plenty of money coming in, our health, our vigour, our youth, and we might be extremists like that. But most people do find difficulties, and most of us don't only because of our youth. And when we cease to be wet behind our ears, we find that life is not pleasant for many, many people in our community. And it's into this kind of crazy, chaotic world that the gospel comes. That is, the message of God. God's message for this mess, if you like. And in the epistle to the Romans, God's message is spelt out over several chapters, many chapters. And so we'll be looking at it in the next 5 or 6 weeks, as we work through the first 5.5 chapters of this epistle. Because of the complexity of ideas in this epistle, we won't be going verse by verse all the way through. The question time might reveal any particularly troublesome verse that you have. It'll most likely be troublesome for me also. But we will not be working like that. Rather, I'm seeking to bring out the key and main themes in each of the chapters, especially as they relate to the gospel that Paul is expounding through these chapters. So this evening, the first 17 verses will be dealt with in a cursory fashion. And we will really be spending the time on the second half, and I'll explain that in a moment why. But let me at least give a nodding acquaintance to you for those first few verses. In verses 1 to 7, Paul speaks of the gospel, and he says it's a gospel about Jesus. I'm sure that is the case, although we will not be speaking very much about Jesus tonight. In subsequent weeks, there will be a lot about him. I do not like preaching away from Jesus, but yet tonight we'll be looking at another problem, of which Jesus is the solution, and the solution will have to come another night. The gospel is about Jesus. And so you see, tonight we won't be really touching on the heart of the gospel, seeing we'll only mention him in passing now. He is the one who comes in the context of the Old Testament prophesied by the Old Testament prophets. He comes as the Son of David, and he is seen to be the Son of God in that he rose from the dead and gave out his Holy Spirit to people to bring to them to new life. And thus he is designated the Son of God. Indeed, Jesus can be summed up under two words, Christ and Lord. We see that in verse 4, Jesus Christ, our Lord. The Christ is the Messiah, the long-appointed King of God. The Lord is the Master. He is the Messiah and the Master. And Paul, in verses 8 to 15, says he's a messenger of this gospel. And he longs to see the Romans and to share with them the faith that they already have in this Lord and Christ, this Jesus. Because he is under obligation, verse 14, told you I was moving quickly, didn't I? Verse 14, he is under obligation to all men, Greeks, barbarian, wise or foolish, whoever they may be, he is under obligation to them to preach the gospel. For the gospel is for all men, everywhere. All manner of people who are here tonight, young, old, intelligent and less than intelligent. There are those of us who are rich and there are those of us who are poor. There's all manner of people here, but the gospel is a gospel for all mankind. And that is why Paul is not ashamed of it, because it is a powerful work for everybody. Greek or Jew, the gospel is the power of God for salvation. If you came to my home and had a look at my tools, by and large, I would be ashamed of most of them. Some are rusty, most are cheap, all of them are ineffective in my hands. I think that's got to do with the hands. If you said, well, look, what do you drill holes with? I'll show you my little hand drill, of which I bought recently. It never drills straight, in my hands anyway. And I'll even show you the cheap drills I bought at a special deal. Once used, then broken, blocking up the hole so that you can't do anything more. That is, I would rather you didn't ask me about it, because I am relatively ashamed of the tools that I own, because they are none too powerful. Paul is not ashamed of the tool of salvation, the tool that God uses to save people, because it is mighty powerful. It actually does the task. He is quite proud of it. He is pleased to be associated with the power of God. For this tool, the gospel, saves people, whoever they may be. And it does more than saves people. It shows that God is righteous at the same time. That is, as God the righteous judge announces his judgment on the world, he also shows mercy to some people. And that is a very strange thing, that God can be both righteous and merciful at the same time. We need to ponder that, because we'll be coming to it several times during the next few weeks. How you can be righteous and yet say to a guilty man, you may go free. Sounds a strange form of righteousness, that, isn't it? To say to a man who's a criminal, who has done all manner of evil, who's been involved in armed robbery, bashing little old ladies, little old men, even university students, who's been engaged in a few murders, who's involved in the heroin trade, in all kinds of things that even our society would say were less than acceptable, in all manner of evil, for God to say to that man, it's all right, you can go free. Now, how can God be righteous
and do that. This message to a world which isn't a chaotic mess, this message shows the mercy of God, the salvation of God, and also the righteousness of God. But in order to see the salvation of God, we need firstly to see the danger from which we are saved. And that is what we'll be looking at tonight, which makes it a fairly black night. It's going to be bad news most of the way here for the rest of this sermon. If you look down to the very last note, you'll see hope for the hopeless. But that'll be a brief note, let me tell you now. In fact, it'll be encouragement to come back next week for brighter news. But it's necessary to be like that. When you're driving along with a friend, your friend's driving, and as he's driving along, he's not paying any attention to where he's going. You've got friends like that, like I have too, haven't you? And he doesn't notice, as you notice, a huge semi-trailer pouring down the road on your right-hand side. It's obviously out of control, going 80, 90 miles an hour, really ripping down the road, and it's going to crash into your car any tick of the clock, right broad beam in the centre, and smash you into smithereens. And so terrifying is the sight that even I lose control and can't say anything. Now, at that point, just because he wants to demonstrate his new car, our friend stamps on the accelerator. Whoosh, off it goes, and the great semi-trailer whizzes past behind us, just missing us. He said, oh, boy, it was a narrow escape that, wasn't it? And the driver, who has not seen any of this, says, was it? Really? What happened? I missed it. He has no perception of how great an escape it was, because he has no perception of how great the danger was. Tonight, Paul gives us the danger. The semi-trailer deal, full bore. It's fairly bad news, the rest of this sermon. That's all the more reason to listen and understand, because as we grasp hold of the danger we are really in, we may be more motivated to move into safety. We may be more thankful for God for how he has moved us into safety. We might indeed have some better understanding of why the world keeps on getting junked up the way it is. God's wrath has been revealed, says Paul in verse 18. That is, God's anger has been revealed. Our God is an angry God. People don't like it, think of him in those terms, but the Bible teaches it quite clearly. And his anger is revealed. Not the anger of petulance. Not that he got out of the bed the wrong side the other day and that's why it's been raining lately. Not that he just feels a bit out of sorts because the onions don't agree with him. That is our kind of anger. God's anger is a righteous anger. It's got to do with justice, as you will hear in a few moments. God's anger has been revealed because of certain reasons. You see the causal connection there in verse 18, where it starts off with the word because, or for in your translation. Down verse 24, the conclusion that comes from verses 18 to 23, therefore God gives people up, and down in verse 26, for this reason God gave them up, and down in verse 28, and since they did not see fit to acknowledge God, God gave them up. For certain reasons, God is acting in anger. Now what are the reasons? Firstly, we need to understand that God has revealed himself clearly. To reveal is to show. Now, it's quite clear that the top little section up here of my skivvy has been ironed. At least those down the front row can see that it has been ironed. But you don't know if the rest has been ironed or not, do you? Those of you who know Helen immediately say, of course it has. Those of you who know me say there's a 50-50 chance it hasn't. You don't know that until I take off my jumper and reveal my skivvy to you. Why I'd want to do that, I don't know. And I'm sure you may not want to see. But revealing has got to do with taking away the covering so that it can be seen. God has revealed himself, says the scriptures. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and wickedness of men who by their wickedness oppress the truth. Verse 19. For what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them ever since the creation of the world. His invisible nature, namely his eternal power and deity, have been clearly perceived in the things that have been made. The creation itself tells you and indeed tells every person who is alive in the creation that there is God, that he exists, that he is powerful. It doesn't tell you very much more than that, but it does tell you that much, that he is there, that he is powerful, and that is clear to all men. Now you say, Philip, are you trying to tell me that you can prove the existence of God from the argument of creation, from creation? No, of course I can't. How in the world I can prove that to you? And in fact, in a few minutes' time, when we deal with the subject, you'll see that I never thought that for a moment, because I know it's impossible to prove it to you. And that's got something to do with you, and it's got something to do with our canons of proof, and it's got something to do with God. Can't prove to you, in the terms in which you're setting out the problem, that God exists out of creation. But I'll tell you something else. You know that he does, because of the created world. Thousands of things I can't prove in life. I can't prove that I love my wife, and I can't prove she loves me, but I don't doubt either fact. Just because you can't prove it doesn't mean it. There's a lovely piece of graffiti up there at the university at the moment. I think it's lovely. Almost everyone I've told it to thinks it's horrible, but I think it's marvellous. It says, sex is better than logic. But I can't prove it. It's a classic piece, that, isn't it? And it's a point. I thought of putting it on the church notice board. You must pray for the parish council and the church wardens. No, I can't prove it in the canons of logic. No, those canons of logic are set up so as to make sure that I won't be able to prove it. There's no way in the world you'll prove it from them. No way in this world you can do that. No. But people all over the world do believe in God. They do believe. They may not call it G-O-D, they may just call it some supernatural being or whatever, but people do, and you ask them why, and they say, well, how else can all this be here? You look at the stars, you look at the water, you look at the bugs and the microbes down the test tube, you look at everything else and you say, well, there must be something here somewhere. You look at a person, you look at a newborn baby, you say, there must be a purpose, there must be someone somewhere who's done something to bring this all into being. People believe it. Cannot prove it, but they don't doubt it. In fact, the number of real atheists are very, very small in the history of mankind. They are indeed rare species. Rare indeed. People do believe because God clearly shows. I've got a lovely Van Gogh now in a study. Someone in the congregation kindly gave it to me. You know, that starry, starry night sits up there in the study beaming down on me. And you can see a lot about the character of Van Gogh in that. Got a Time Life book out on Van Gogh. Another friend of the congregation lent it to me. And at the back of the Time Life book on Van Gogh, it's got a series of self-portraits, because he was a lover of painting himself. He wasn't very rich and couldn't afford to get people to pose for him. And as you see through the series, moving from his early Dutch period onwards, you see the man's mind slowly losing. Not only in the picture of the person you see there, that he himself becomes more and more demented, but in the way in which he portrays himself, becomes stranger and stranger. And you know something of him by what he has created. People know of God from what they have created. They know he's there. They know he's powerful. But yet they do not want that piece of information, says Paul, but rather they suppress the truth because of wickedness. Here is a crucial part of Paul's understanding of mankind. Here is actually we're lying now at very fundamental views of Christianity, and an important passage indeed to grasp hold of. He says that because we are wicked, we do not want God. And therefore, although we know there is a God, we hold off that truth. We suppress that truth. We cover it up and we pretend it's not there. It's not true. That is, you say, but Philip, all the way along you've been saying, oh yeah, there's God, everyone believes in God. I don't. And Paul says, that's right, you don't. That is exactly the point. You know he's there, but you don't want him to be there. And so you'll be working inside your own self, holding down that piece of information. Now, why don't we want him to be there? What is it that about us that doesn't want God to be there? Well, if God is the creator of all this massive world, he is the creator of me. And if he's the creator of all the world and he rules all the world, it's all his world, he is the owner of the world, he can do with the world as he wants, then that's true of what he can do with me. He made me. He rules me. He owns me. He governs me. He can do with me. I don't like that idea too much. I don't want someone else running my life. I like trying to do it myself. But the acknowledgement of the Creator is the acknowledgement of my contingency, is the acknowledgement that I am dependent on someone else, and that I am actually obliged to somebody else. And I don't like living in obligation to any person. And I'll tell you something else, folks, I'm not Robinson Crusoe in this matter. None of us like that. We want to do our own thing, our own way, and the concept of God is in basic interference with me doing my thing my way. And so I suppress that piece of information, and I live my life in a contradiction. I believe in God, but I don't want to have anything to do with him, except I don't mind praying when I get in a bit of trouble. As they say, there's no atheists in foxholes. You've got to know what a foxhole is to know what that means, but if you don't, never mind, we'll press on to the next illustration. When I'm in times of trouble, I can say, oh yeah, God, come and help me then. When I come to a great point in my life, like, say, my marriage, I don't mind having everything going for me that possibly could be going for me. I don't mind even some kind of mystic feelings in those times. It'd be kind of nice to have a real nice, quiet, gentle kind of experience of some supernatural, warm, benevolent feeling. I don't mind a bit of God every now and then, but I don't like that one which says, I am obliged to him, that I owe him anything, that he can tell me to do anything. I don't want that one. And so I suppress the truth. And so Paul sums it up like this in verses 22 and 23, claiming to be wise, they become fools, and exchange the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man, birds, animals, reptiles. Or down in verse 25 he says, because they exchange the truth about God for a lie, and worship and serve the creature rather than the Creator. And down in verse 28, he says, and since they did not see fit to acknowledge God, God gave them up. So that's the character of people. We know there is God, but we won't acknowledge him. We actually will worship other things than him. We will change and exchange the glory of God for things that are less than God because we can cope with them. Now the pattern of God's wrath is that he then does for people what they want. He gives them up. Verse 24, 26 and 8, repeat that phrase, a terrible phrase when you think of its implications. Therefore God gave them up. God hands them over to their own desires in verse 24, called lusts here, which turn out to be dishonourable desires and passions, you see, in verse 26, because they come in verse 28 from a base mind. See, a mind that is actually based upon the idea of a lie, that I'm not going to live my life for God, although I know that there is God. The life that is based on a lie is one that really is distorted at its very root. But that's the nature. God gives people up to do their own thing, to do what they want. It's like as if we're small dogs pulling at a leash. You know those mad, stupid little mutts. I'm sorry if you own one of those beautiful little silk terriers. You know those little ones that keep on pulling at the leash all the time, running around like mad rabbits. And I don't understand. In the end, he says, oh, you go your own way then. Off it chases after this pigeon and that cat and up and down and round about in the leaves and across the road till it's run over. Now, you know that kind of mad, stupid little dog, desperate to do its own thing, until the owner no longer wishes to protect it from its own folly and gives it up to do its own thing. That is what God does. He gives up people to do their own thing. And off we head. Here, friends, is the nature of the word sin. See, when I use the word sin, which I by and large avoid, most people think of the idea of sex. It's a three-letter word that starts with S, and it must be just the same thing, because that's what Christians always talk about, and so therefore that's what it must be. That's got nothing to do with it at all, of course, because sex is a good thing given by God for man's enjoyment and for procreation. So it's not sin. Well then, what is sin? Well, it must be doing lots of naughty little things. But that's not what it's about either. They might be manifestations of sin, they might be symptoms of the disease, but they're not sin. That's not what it is. Sin is rebellion against God. That's what sin is. It is rebellion. It is saying, yeah, God is the God of all the universe, but not of me. I'm going to do my thing my way. I am going to be my God. He can be God over there of the Himalayas, and he can be God of the Andes, and he can be God of the Nullarbor, but he's not God of Philip Jensen. Philip Jensen's going to be God of Philip Jensen. That basic rebellion, that is what is sin. And that is why you find good people, people who have never ever stolen from the tax people, because they choose not to steal on their tax forms. They've never murdered anybody, because they choose never to murder anybody. They've never told lies, I don't know who that person is, but they never tell lies because they choose not to tell lies. And they look good people, but they are utterly rebellious and godless, because they have always done things on the basis of their choice. That is all they do. And if they were a different person, they would choose to steal from the tax office. They would murder. They would choose to lie. But it's their choice, not God's. So that is what sin is. Doing our own thing. Our own rebellion. Doing it by myself. And God's wrath falls upon that. For God is God. And we know him to be God. Yet we will not do what we know. And therefore God holds us accountable. And he punishes us in his anger. But notice the nature of the punishment. It's beautiful, this system. See, the great problem with retribution is how to make the punishment fit the crime. You see the problem in the Muslim world at the moment, don't you? A man steals something, off comes the hand. Does that punishment fit the crime? Westerners say no. Muslims say, well, they don't steal twice, do they? Yes, they've got another hand. How do you get the punishment fit the crime? And of course the age-old one is, what do you do to the rapist? And there's all kinds of other problems like that. How do you get the punishment to fit the crime? Now, what do you do to a man who is rebellious against God? God makes it fit, the punishment fits the crime beautifully here. He says, you don't want me? To which the rebel, he says, no, I don't want you to interfere with me. God says, all right, I won't interfere with you. You go your own way, do your own thing by yourself. That is God's punishment. You ponder it for a moment. No man can complain about that, can they? They are getting exactly what they asked for, aren't they? Precisely what they asked for. They ask to be left alone, and so God leaves them alone. Thus God's righteous anger can be seen. It's not peevish, not petty. People say, leave me alone, God. And so God says, all right, I respect your desire to be left alone. You go your own way. He gives them up. But the results of that wrath, the results of that action of God, are disastrous. Far-reaching. Terrifying. My little boy Matthew has now mastered the art of dominoes. So the illustration I told a couple of years ago, which illustrates this point, is now ancient history. But I'll still use it again, because it captures the point clearly, it seems to me. You all know the principle of dominoes, don't you? Oh, I'm sorry if you don't. It's a very simple game. Very, very simple game. And it was one of the first ones I tried Matthew out on. I bought him little dominoes which had flowers on it rather than the numbers, because I thought it would be simpler. What I didn't know was that by the time you've got enough brains to understand the game, you've got enough brains to use numbers. So if you're going to buy those dominoes little flowers on it, forget it, it's a waste of money. Good building blocks nonetheless. Now, I started teaching Matthew this game of dominoes. Dead simple, I thought. But he was losing. Which is random chance and dominoes, I may say. He was losing, and so he didn't like this game very much. And so he devised a new way of playing it, which gave him the edge, one could say. The only trouble was, the rules he made up were absolutely illogical. I mean, there was no rationale at all except that Matthew was going to win. However, so irrational were the rules that he couldn't even control with certainty that he would win. The thing just did not make sense. There was no sense at all. You could just throw the dominoes in any old time you wanted to. It was crazy. It was like playing with little blocks. That's all it was. It was a game of little blocks. There was no game of dominoes left. But he wanted to do it his way, even though his way ruined the game. Utterly. So that in the end it left the dad so frustrated that he didn't even have a partner to play with anymore. There was nothing left but the little blocks. And when he had them all to himself, he didn't want them either. That rebellion against the way in which the owner of the game spells it out can be disastrous. Now, God has not finally left the game. God is still here. The world is still relatively orderly, this created universe. There are still good people doing good things because God's Spirit is at work in them. Wherever there's disasters around the world, you see the Cup of Tea Brigade and the Band-Aid Corps. They're always around there, people trying to bring good out of the evil. You always see that there are people around who try and tell the truth. The whole world is not in a total chaotic mess because God has not finally given it up, but he will. Eventually he will totally withdraw, and with him will come all things of good and right and true, all things that are excellent and lovely and beautiful, all things that make for orderliness and good society. All those will go with God when God withdraws, and men will actually finally be able to have that which they've longed for, their own world where they can be God by themselves. And by themselves in eternity they will be. But in the meantime, even in this world, man stays in a terrible mess. Because man does not deny God, he suppresses God. If he outright denied God, he might be a bit better off, but he actually suppresses God. The word used here is a word that's an interesting one. It's the idea of holding things down. I don't know if you've tried to hold a balloon down in a big puddle of water sometime, in a bathtub or something or other. But you get a really nice big balloon, especially made of soft rubber that's not pushed up, blown up too tight, and you hold it down. And one of its great problems is it tends to pop up in another area. Indeed, you hold it down in the middle with some of them and they pop up at either end for you. And when you reach out and hold down the two ends, the middle pops up again. And you can't control the thing in your attempt to suppress it. But each time it pops up, what pops up is a distortion of the reality. It's not the real balloon shape you're seeing anymore. It's just a bit of the balloon that's shoved out of shape. And what it is it's a testimony to the reality that you are holding something down. But it's no testimony to what the shape of that reality really is. So it is with godliness. We believe in God. We know God is there. But he's going to interfere with me, so I just keep that down tight. But I can't live in a world without God. I keep introducing him. In this bit or that bit or here or there, in all manner of superstition and religion and all kinds of crazy things that are God distorted, but are symbols of the existence of God. I understand 80% of Australians read the Stars columns each day in the newspapers. And what even staggers me more, according to the Gallup poll, 28% of them believe in them and live by them. That's a crass stupidity, isn't it? That 1/12 of the community, what's that, 1 million people, have the same future tomorrow. I mean, there are few things more stupid than astrology. I mean, you can bend my arm if you like, and I'll be very polite to all manner of religions around the world, but I'm blowed if I can be to astrology. A man who takes that seriously really is a man who has got severe psychological problems. No two ways about it. And by the way, a couple of countries close by here, like one of our nearest neighbours, the government's run by it, like Hitler tried to run Germany by it. Now, what is astrology about? It's about people who know the existence of God, but who don't want God running their lives. And so instead of worshipping God, they worship the stars. We think we live in a very educated, highly highfalutin society where we're beyond basic superstitions. What rubbish. You go into any jeweller in the city and you'll find the place filled up with all the junk under the sun showing this form of superstition or another. You can wander into the university cooperative bookshop and buy things on the I Ching, on astrology, on love by the stars, all kinds of things that you can find. Whether a Gemini will go with whatever it will go with or whatever it won't go with. And you make decisions on those kinds of, what stupidity. But it's not a stupidity really that's beyond understanding. It's got to do with the fact that people do believe in the reality beyond this world. They just don't like that belief. And so they try and create something that's better. Like Matthew that tries to create a domino game that is better than dominoes. But it's a disaster. Absolute stupid disaster. And that is how people will wish to live. Oh, let me not be rude to all the religions under the sun. Let me be rude to the Church of England for a few moments, so that you will know that I'm in no way biased or prejudiced in this regard. Because in the Church of England you can get enough stupidity in the regard, can't you? There are people who think that God lives in this building. Now, I know it's a fairly large building, but that's absurd. But there are people who think that. You see, when you're in here, you're closer to God than when you're out there in Oxford Street. I tell you, the way they drive out there, you might be closer out there than being in here. There are people who actually think that somehow there is a mystic quality in Gothic architecture. There's no mystic quality, it's just very expensive to maintain. That's the only problem with Gothic architecture. You don't come closer to God because the ceiling's got a point on it, do you? That's an absurdity. You don't come closer to God because the windows can let in coloured light. As if God somehow is coloured light, or can be transformed into it or transferred into it. You don't think you come closer to God because religious people do religious things in religious buildings, dressing their religious people up in religious clothing and saying very religious words which you can never understand. That doesn't make you somehow closer to God because you've become in a meaningless situation. That's a stupidity that people go on with. All manner of people wander into the building to pray religious prayers, who do not want God to do anything with their lives outside, who will come to the minister and say, will you pray for me? And I'll say, certainly. What would you like me to pray about? Oh, it doesn't matter, just pray for me. How can I share with you the gospel of Jesus and tell you the great thing? Oh, I don't want to hear about God, just pray for me. I tell you, it's full of a ritual of stupidities, and it's got to do with the fact that people believe there is a God. But they don't want him. And in their attempt to hold him down, he keeps popping out in a disfigured fashion. And it's all through the world, this idolatry. And of course, you cannot help it. I've just spoken of the religious kind, but if you'd like to check out sometime, there are irreligious kinds as well. They're all religious in the end. But they're irreligious like materialism. Coveting, which is materialism, the Bible calls idolatry, because you are living for things. And you weigh up sometime how much our society is caught up in that. I wonder sometimes what an archaeologist in 200 or 300 years' time will make of going out to a place like one of the car tracks. And he digs it up and he sees where all these bashed cars have been going around and round in front of a huge auditorium of people. I wonder what he'll make of that. What kind of religious service was going on in this form of gladiatorial metalware? What were they doing in their praise of the mighty gas guzzler? I'm sure those of you who are car fanatics can tell me all the advantages of learning how to develop new cars so that we can drive better ones out there and all that garbage. But you and I know basically it's got to do with a religion. It's got to do with people's needs and desires to have something beyond their own humdrum, boring life and existence. And it's not for nothing that they advertise those by spectacular smashes. And more than that, part of the terrible dilemma of our own game, playing it our own way, is that it enters there into a terrible bias. Ponder it for a moment with me, please. We like to be unbiased and unprejudicial. But you ponder for a moment about God and bias. For if at the root of the system of my life is the desire that God's not there, I'll be very hard-pressed to be unbiased, won't I? If that is what really lies at the heart of it all, that I know he's there but I don't want him to be there, then I will be biased whenever the subject of God comes up. I won't like the subject of God coming up. I'd rather it didn't. Those of you who have invited people to the Billy Graham Crusade recently know exactly what I mean, don't you? When you get those lovely refusals, oh, I'm busy. There are 20 nights. I mean, I've got a pretty full calendar, let me tell you. I'm out nearly every night of every week, but even I could squeeze a couple of visits in. I say, it's going to be very cold out there. I'll provide blankets. Well, I don't like that kind of mass emotionalism anyway. Have you been out there? No. Well, how do you know it's mass emotionalism? Well, the papers say so. You believe everything in the papers? No. Well, why do you believe that bit? Well, I don't really want to go and hear that. I've heard it before. What's he say? I can't remember. There is a keen inquirer for truth. There is the honest and open mind, which is first cousin to the empty head. Now, that bias lies in us because we don't want God telling us what to be doing. I want to live life for myself, my own way. Answer this for a moment in your own quietness and your thinking. Do you want someone else running your life for you? I'm not talking about God now, anybody. You want somebody else running your life for you. Now, those of you who may be Christians might want to say, yes, I want Jesus to run my life. Those of you who have been thoroughly and utterly henpecked might want to say, yes, I want my wife to run my life. She's done a great job, hasn't she? I can't imagine many in that category, but it's possible, I suppose. But I guarantee there's no one here who's sitting here saying, well, I don't care if somebody else does or not. No one's going to sit in that neutral position. That neutral position doesn't exist, does it? Well, you can say, I don't care if I become a slave or if I remain free. It's about half a dozen the other, really. Balderdash, if ever I heard it. Everybody wants a choice at that point. And as soon as you make a choice at that point, then you are biased about every piece of information that comes in concerning the master. You cannot help but be biased. And because your natural instinct is exactly the same as yours and yours and yours and mine, that is that I want to run my own life my own way, mankind is biased against God. Isn't that crazy, you see? Everybody believes in him and everyone's biased against him. Doesn't that make sense of the world as we see it? Superstition, religion, belief in God, widespread. People committing their life to God, rare as hen's teeth. Isn't that the way most people you meet in the street, they believe in God. Gallup polls tell us that, 85% or something other Australians say they believe in God. What are they doing about it? Reading the stars. That's what they're doing about it. This is that basic inconsistency. It runs right through the society. It runs right through the hearts of people here. Hey, I believe in him, but just don't want him to interfere with me. That is the nature of sin. That's what it's all about. And, of course, the end of it is utterly destructive of the people, like Matthew's game of dominoes. It's a chaotic mess in the end. And that's what it's like here. Homosexuality, lesbianism, and then look at the list down there in verse 29. They were filled with all manner of wickedness, evil, covetousness, malice, full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, malignancy, gossip, slanderers, haters of God, insolent, haughty. Tell you what, you don't have to buy the Sunday newspapers each week. Just read this passage. It's all here. Haters of God, insolent, haughty, boastful, inventors of evil, disobedient to parents. I mean, they even put a little book out a few years ago called The Little Red School Book, which tells you how to be disobedient to your parents. Foolish, faithless, heartless, ruthless. You say, well, look, that's a bit of a hard statement, isn't it? I mean, society's not all that bad. No, it's not yet. It's not that bad yet. Because God in his goodness is still playing the game with us. But when he stops, that is what it will be like totally. And we get the foretaste of it even here now in this society. And look at the list. I mean, there are murderers there, and I guess there are not many of us who have committed murder here. Other than in our heart, of course. But there are others. Gossips. Oh, nobody's gossiped here, have they? Haven't met a gossiper ever in St. Matthias, so they don't come. People talk about them so much. Slanderers. No one would ever say a bad thing about it. I mean, that is the real world. That is the world where you need a great metal door on your doorstep to stop people from coming in to you. That is the world where you can't leave your car without locking it up. Where you've got to insure your goods, otherwise you lose them. That is the world, isn't it? Where you've got to have laws about libel to protect yourself. That is the law. That is the world where you can't get involved with anybody. Saw Alan Funt last night on Candid Camera. Thought he was old, so old to be a candid inside his box, really. However, there was Candid Camera. First time I've seen it in 10 years. And he says, 26 years old, that show. You know the great scene, don't you? Well, I had an interesting one there last night. There was a bloke, Alan Funt it turned out to be, all bound up, head to toe, blindfold on, strapped to a chair. And a man comes in and sits down next to him. And the bloke all bound up says to him, hey mate, can you help me? He says, all right, no. He says, please help me. Oh, no, he says, no, I won't get involved with that. Help me, please, get me out of this. He says, well, who are you? He says, well, take the blindfold off and you can see. Oh, no, I'm not going to take that off until you tell me who you are. After all, he says, I'm Alan Funt. He says, well, how can I believe that? Well, take the blindfold off and see. He says, oh, no, I'm not going to tell you to show me that you're Alan Funt. There's a classic, isn't it? There is a world that's so helpful for mankind, isn't it? It actually happened. I know it was staged, but the man who was there didn't know it was being staged. He didn't know that at all. When I was at Manly, a man sat on a park bench down there on the Corso. Sat there for 3 days, and nobody spoke to him in 3 days. At least, no one we know of, because he was dead for all 3 of them. It's a busy street, people walking up and down all the time. Been dead for over 3. I would have thought, like Lazarus, there was a certain odour. People walk past in 3 days. There is the world, heartless. That is the world. If you don't experience it like that, it's got to do with the wetness behind the ears. Go and live. That's what it's like. And why is it like that? Why do men hate each other? Because they live a life based on a lie. They know there's God, but they won't have him. That's why it's in the mess it is. And it reaches its pinnacle in our media. They're described in verse 32 for you. There is the media in all their magnificence, from the ABC through to every commercial channel you like. Though they know God's decree that those who do such things deserve to die, they not only do them, but they also approve of those who practice them. What is it today I saw on the truth? Ex-PM's wife says, Prince Charles and me. You've got to buy that, haven't you? I mean, you're sure the editor's going to say tut tut inside as he gives you every lurid detail of what I expect will be fat nothing. But you've got to buy it. They not only practice them, they approve of the very things that they know to be wrong. The gospel of wrath, gospel and wrath. God is a just God, very righteous and just. And his righteousness and his wrath are revealed in the gospel because you see God angry with man's sinfulness, man's rebellion against God, but his anger is contained so that he pays them exactly what they deserve. They don't want him, they can't have him. Man is fully culpable for that, because nobody's ignorant. There is no man who has never heard of God. Every man knows of God. The deepest, darkest jungles, even to other parts of Sydney, they all know God, and they can all know him. For he is clearly perceived in the things that he has made. So we are all can be held responsible for our rejection and rebellion against God. Well then, what hope is there in a world that is like that, where people are so caught up in idolatry, so caught up in suppression, so caught up in this lie, so caught up in the bias against God, that there is no hope for them except to wreck their own world and their futures in eternity? What hope can there be? The gospel of Jesus is the hope that comes into that world. That is the hope. For there you see God sending his Son to rescue us from this world and the final judgment as well. But that's what we've got to go on with. I told you it was going to be a black night.